Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and I'm here with the one and only AU professor and two-time Oscar winner, Russell Williams. Russell, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invite.
Well, this has been a long time coming because I'm trying to remember, it was probably a year or so ago, we heard that you are going to be donating your two Oscars as well as a Nagrasound machine to the brand new Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture downtown on the Mall. How did they contact you, first of all, and what was sort of behind your decision to donate? Because these are some prized possession of yours, sir.
Yeah, many people have asked me that, Jason, and in terms of why I want to donate. I'm a D.C. native, and I felt that, and not only D.C., but Southeast D.C. So most of the time, Southeast shows up in the news now, someone is dead. That's not the Southeast I grew up in. And hopefully, as a longtime friend and admirer of the Smithsonian collection as a kid, I said, well, maybe my statuettes might inspire some young people, you know, to understand that not only can they win Oscars behind camera, but, you know, you can actually fulfill your dream if you're persistent enough. As far as how they reached me, it's the other way around. I reached them. So what happened, 2014, I want to say it was April 15th, the director, Lonnie Bunch, who's also an AU alum, was hosting a screening of 42.
Oh, the Jackie Robinson.
Absolutely, the Jackie Robinson film. And they screened that at the National Museum of American History.
They came to the White House, too, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I went to see that movie because my dad was a big Jackie Robinson fan. I mean, every time I did a half-ass job with something, either in the yard or around the house, he would always say, Jackie Robinson, if Jackie Robinson, you know.
That's not how Jackie would do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and plus he had 20,000 people screaming at him the whole time. So I really came to see the movie for two reasons. One, just to see it, and two, to see, because his eyesight was getting a little dim, to see whether he would be able to appreciate it. Mm. And so at the end of that, and of course the filmmakers were there and Lonnie did a great interview. And so, you know, we reconnected, how have you been, so forth and so on. I said, oh yeah, and by the way, would you like a couple of Academy Awards and a couple of Emmys? And his eyes lit up. He said, let's make an appointment. And so we actually talked in August of that year. And then he put me with his curators and, you know, they're downtown already. I mean, they've had them since 2014.
Oh, so they've been out of your possession for that long.
A long time, yeah. They've been dusting them off and sorting out what of the stuff I gave them they wanted to put on display first. So
it's got to be cool, though, to be able to bring, you know, family members, friends to the museum. I mean, I know it's not going to be in your house, so it's hard to let them go, I'm sure. But it's almost even cooler to be able to go there and see a plaque and, you know, that's special stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, when I lived in L.A. and the Oscars were brand new, there was a lot of foot traffic, you know, right. But as they've gotten older. And also, I thought that rather than to wait until later and maybe family members want one or somebody wants, I said, let me just put these in the Smithsonian for safekeeping. And I know that they'll always be part of our national collection. But I blame my mom and my dad as a kid. One summer, my mom said, well, we're going to every building in Washington that has a tour. And, Jason, I couldn't think of a worse possible, you know, it's like, what? I already had my summer planned out. I was going to throw rocks at the girls, and I was going to play softball and stuff. But as we did these tours and as we went into these great buildings and I saw all of these exhibits, I mean, I never thought then I would have anything to contribute right. to the Smithsonian. But it may sound corny, but the years I lived in Los Angeles, I actually missed having a facility like that with all of these different diverse pieces of art and history and what have you, airplanes, of course.
You take them for granted when you're here.
You do. And it's free.
Yeah.
You know, and it's all in one spot for the most part. If I wanted to hit four or five museums in L.A., I may have to drive 100 miles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so, but it wasn't until I heard that because the museum has been rumored and talked about for decades. I mean, I think technically 100 years, but I think in the last 40 years, there was a lot more buzz about it. And when I heard that it was actually going to happen, I said, that's a thought, you know. And then I had to convince myself that I could part with them and not have, you know, this regret that, well, did I make a mistake? But as soon as I saw them I went down to the donors display this past Saturday and I said, okay, That's fitting. I'm happy.
What will our listeners, if they head out there this weekend, what are they going to see in the exhibit? Explain, it's the two Oscars, but tell them also what a Nagra is, because a lot of people listening probably don't know what it is.
Well, long before we had the iPods and all these digital devices that everybody just puts in their pocket and carries around and sometimes walks out in front of traffic unknowingly, in order for us to record live dialogue on the set, this recorder called a Nagra, which it's already heavy without batteries in it, and it carried 12 D-cell batteries. Okay, those of you who don't know what a D-cell is, Google it. Okay, and so that allowed me and other people who did my job as a production sound mixer, either slung over your shoulder or you have like a portable cart that's on wheels, you were able to record on quarter-inch tape. Google that if you're not familiar with that. And we would actually get the live dialogue of the actors while they were being filmed. And you had to have more than one. So they have two of mine. They have a 4.2, which is a mono machine, meaning only one channel, and a 4S, which is a two-track machine. Pretty much all the people who do the job I used to do now have eight channels available to them or more, all digital, no tape. You know, a lot easier to move your content around than in my day. But one thing that Nagra would do, it would work hot, cold, you know, while you were running in cars, helicopters that were doing banks, it would continue to run and stay in sync.
Wow. Now, how did you even get into that in the first place? I mean, you talked about being a kid here in Southeast and going to the museums, but where did the film spark start and how did you make your way west? How'd you go west, young man?
Interesting, yeah. Well, I think my first professional exposure to, let's say, to sound, because I was a piano student and I also played sousaphone and tuba in Wilson's concert orchestra back in the 70s. Yeah. But my first real professional exposure to sound was at WAMU-FM while I was still a student at American U. So from 70 to 74, and then the radio show continued into the 80s. 79, I moved to L.A. What got me into the film side of things was first, as a teenager, seeing this film that Sidney Poitier and Rod Steiger were in called In the Heat of the Night. And so not only were they so impressive on camera, but by that time I was listening to a lot of jazz, and I said, wait a minute. Quincy Jones did the score.
Yeah. And now, that Ray Charles opening theme too. Yeah.
Ray Charles, and then Rosson Roland Kirk was playing some of the flute solos. Yeah. And so the whole concept of an African American working behind the camera was a revelation. I mean, obviously we'd had African American actors in front of camera, you know, since the silent days. So it wasn't an immediate like, okay, I've got to go to Hollywood, but at least something tapped me on the shoulder. This is something to be continued. Now, back in the Jurassic period when I started working for the networks, my first real break was at NBC Washington. I did every day of the Watergate hearings as an engineer.
No joke. I didn't know that.
Yep. I never went to the Hill, but I was always up on Nebraska Avenue.
Wow.
But I had, by the time I had changed my major from journalism to broadcast production, and then after working at NBC, I said, well, I don't need to take classes in broadcast production. I'm putting on the Today Show. I'm doing nightly news and so forth. So I decided to take some film classes because that was our tradition. Sunday school, church, Sunday dinner, and pick a movie.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize how many films I had seen, even though I couldn't tell you what this shot was called and who directed this. But my love of film as a medium really was fostered at American. A professor named Dr. Frank Taraj was the person who really encouraged me and everybody else in the class to go out and see films from international filmmakers. So subtitles became, you know, a regular weekly event for me. And back then we were still shooting news on film. So one of the reasons I left Channel 4 is that at Channel 7 at the time, not only were they shooting hard news on film, but they also had a documentary unit. And this gentleman named Paul Fine, whose son and daughter-in-law are also Oscar winners.
They came in here and brought their Oscars in here. Yeah, for Innocente.
Absolutely. Yep. I mean, you know, I mean that's at least three generations of super talent because Paul's father was the Redskin photographer. Mm-hmm. Paul did that as well as he and his wife Holly worked at 7. They also worked 60 Minutes. Well, they opened the door for me, and so I started working as the second documentary unit sound recordist.
I see.
And the first real job I had after getting that position, 3 weeks later, we were in Rome, you know, doing some filming. And I said, oh, okay. So this is doable. So not only do I see the world, do what I love to do, and somebody else picks up the tab. I mean,
you can't beat that.
Can't beat that. It still took me another 4 years to decide to move to L.A. Right. But what precipitated that, there was a small independent film that came here to shoot. Now, I don't think that film was ever released.
Okay.
But those were the first group of people I actually met that had a what then would have been what was L.A.'s area code? A 213 area code.
Okay.
So I took some numbers down in about a year of saving up money. And I think my last job here in town was at WMAL Radio as an engineer. I said, okay, I'll take the Nestlé plunge. There was this airline called TWA.
Oh, yes.
Google that, you young folks.
Yes.
And July 21, I had a 90-day leave of absence from WMAL. So it was sink or swim. And in those 90 days, they gave me enough of a hook that I could work freelance and continue to make a living. So I quit my job, packed the rest of the stuff on another flight, had some of it sent out by Amtrak, and then another 25 years. You know, it took me 7 years to get in the union. It took me 9 years to get on my first real feature film, meaning in the sense that it was not only a great script, great actors, and just a joy to work on. That was a little movie called Field of Dreams.
Yeah, you might have heard of it.
Might have heard of
some
it.
Some famous sound as well.
and Jason, I never looked back from that point on, you know. But but I think that anybody that gets off the plane in LAX, and I tell my students at American, trust me, this is not an original idea. It wasn't an original idea when I did it.
Yeah.
So expect there to be a long line in front of you. And I think the first set that I saw when I was in L.A. at the time, the MGM Studios, which are now Sony, one of my buddies who had moved out a year ahead of time, a year before I went out, worked on Dallas.
Oh, yes.
And so when you went on the Dallas stage, Jason, J.R. Ewing's house was built full scale on one half of the sound stage, two Mercedes in the garage, a little swimming pool in the back. On the other side of the soundstage were all the what we call swing sets. So
yeah.
His office, or if somebody was making a doctor visit, or somebody was going to see the golf pro. And I sat there and I said, okay, all of this for a little television show? And see, back then TV was like, you know, if you want to really be in the business, you want to be in features. I mean, now television
is flipped. Yeah,
it's a great medium to be involved in. But I stood on that soundstage, Jason, and I said, okay, 10 years before I can throw in the towel and go home. Meaning not like I could go home for holidays and birthdays and things like that, but in terms of quitting and going back to whatever I was doing here, I said, it's going to take at least 10 years. And so, as I said, 7 years to get in the union, 9 years to get on a real movie. First Emmy was 1988. That also was 9 years in. And first Oscar, 10 years in. 89. So I said, okay, I guess I can stay another 10 years.
That's awesome. Yeah, I definitely, because you mentioned Field of Dreams, I want to go into all the movies. But before that, you know, more broadly,
sure.
You know, and you mentioned Sidney Poitier earlier, but when if someone asks sort of the trivia fact, you know, who's the first African-American to win to donate to this museum, you'd be, you know, most folks on the street might say, oh, was it Sidney? Was it Denzel, Spike, or Quincy Jones, you know? But it's you, sir. How cool, you know, how much of an honor is it for that distinction?
Well, Jason, I would say for sure that especially when these Oscars were brand new, I would always say I may not be the first African-American who deserves to be the first multiple winner, but I'll take that distinction.
Yeah.
You know, I'll take it. I think when I really started working on bigger pictures, I had hoped to be the first African-American to win for sound. But rightly, another multiple winner, a gentleman named Willie Burton, and he had been doing great work and had been in the union actually before I even came to L.A. And I want to say he won his first Oscar in 1989 for Buddy Holly's Story.
Okay.
He won his second one many years later for Dreamgirls. So I said, okay, well, that record's already gone. So then I win the very next year for Glory. Yeah. There's no way, I win again for Dances. This is no way. It's not going to happen. And then when it happened, I said, okay, well, here's a record. Because then I went and scrupulously looked. And, of course, then there was no Google. There was no IMDb.com.
It's harder to look it up.
Yeah, much harder to look it up back then. So I was kind of hesitant to announce after the actual, well, during the little press shoot that happens behind stage, I announced to the press corps that I was the first African-American to win multiple Oscars. And then they quizzed me. They said Quincy Jones, I said 6 nominations, no wins. They said Whoopi Goldberg, I said 2nd nomination, 1 win. Yeah. So then they left me alone, and it actually turned out to be a little line on the front page of Variety. It's the first time I ever hit, and probably the last time I was on the front page of the trades. So, but yeah.
Until after this interview, of course.
Okay, hey, you know what? That to me is something always to look forward to. I'm also happy to say that I think partly because I worked behind camera, because one of the things I noticed going in with the actors, I mean, if you're an actor, it doesn't matter ethnicity. People are going to make, and they really do make a face value judgment right then.
Right.
You're too tall. You're too old. That's not the look we're looking for. Have you dyed your hair blonde? Can you gain 10 pounds? Can you lose 20 pounds?
Whereas you're judged more on the work.
Right.
Behind the scenes.
You turn that button on and you heard the actors and you heard Denzel, you heard James Earl Jones, you heard Kevin Costner, and they didn't sound like Mickey Mouse or somebody else. Yeah. Okay, then I guess this person did their job. Now, the other thing to mention, and I think this is true for any role on camera or behind camera, all our work is collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
So, but in the way the Oscars are structured, if you win for cinematography, the cinematographer usually goes up by him or herself.
Right.
In sound, it would be myself and then generally 2 or 3 post-production people, because you're not supposed to really be able to tell the difference between what I did on location and what they've done later. Obviously, the big orchestra wasn't there when, say, Burt Lancaster steps over the baseline and helps Kevin's daughter.
Not
right?
enough room on the field for the whole orchestra.
You know, not enough acreage.
Disappearing into the corn with instruments.
Right, you know, but we could. But that's another interesting trivia piece about Field of Dreams.
Let's just dive into Field of Dreams, baby. Go ahead.
Well, man.
Personal favorite of mine. I love that movie.
Oh, look. I mean, my dad and I went to see it together, and because my mom and dad were very kind of like, well, we were kind of frightened that you left your permanent job at the Library of Congress to take this temporary job at Channel 4, right, during Watergate. I said, but this is the industry I want to be in.
Right.
And so, but I was still in D.C., so, you know, I was seeing them regularly. Then I decided, hey, look, I'm going to move to Los Angeles. They were, oh, no. And then, of course, I'd been out there many years, and there weren't that many things I could, you know, I'd worked on the Billionaire Boys Club miniseries and some things like that that were decent that turned up on television. But in terms of feature films, this was the first feature film that we had actually had a chance to go see together that I worked on.
Wow.
And then my dad said, okay, now I know.
I get
why
it.
You moved across country, and you know, I'm just honored.
And such father-son themes in the movie,
yeah, I mean,
too.
I thought that movie should have won everything it was nominated for, number one, because it's not really that unusual to go to a movie, especially in those eras where you would see women crying in the theater, but to see guys crying in a movie theater, that almost never happens.
It still gets me.
I mean, are you kidding?
We interviewed Kevin Costner. It was over the phone, of course.
Okay.
It wasn't in person like you.
Okay.
And he basically said, you know, and I agree, it's this generation's It's a Wonderful Life.
Absolutely.
It's that magical fantasy, magical realism thing, and I just adore the movie.
I mean, when since some of this stuff was done in post-production, so I was completely unprepared for when Ray Liotta, Shoeless Joe, is walking towards the corn for the last time, and they establish a telepathic relationship, and he says, it was you.
Yeah.
And then Liotta says, no, Ray, it was you. It's like,
gets me.
All
and Dad, you want to catch him. The whole end.
The whole end of it is just like, oh, my goodness. I mean, it still works. But while we were shooting that summer, 1988, was probably the worst drought that Iowa had seen.
Oh.
So the corn wasn't even up to belt level. It wasn't even belt
high. What did they say, knee high by the 4th
right,
of July
right, exactly.
usually?
Yeah, and so in order for the gag to work in movie parlance, in order for them to be able to walk into the corn and for ILM's you know, visual effects to work, the corn had to be above everybody's head. So they actually literally had to truck in water from the Mississippi. So what we did is on our shooting schedule, we moved into the scenes in Dubuque, subbing for Boston, where we meet James Earl Jones, and you know, Kevin's going up and down the street looking
go the distance.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we're doing
you saw
these
it.
Things. Waiting for the corn to finally get high enough to cover the actors' heads.
Yeah.
I say that James Earl Jones was one of the classic, but not only that, but for me as a guy, like I said, as a kid going to the movies with my parents, I couldn't believe I'm sitting here recording Burt Lancaster.
Unbelievable. Moonlight Grant.
As old as he was, he still had that jaw, man. He still had that glint in his eye.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, I think that's the only time I can remember where I teared up on set because, see, when we're shooting on set, I don't have the benefit of the music and the effects and everything else. But when he stepped over that bass pad to attend to Kevin's daughter, and I was sitting there, and I was like, why am I misty-eyed? You know, that's Bert, man. Bert could deliver a line. He could, as we said, Dustin Hoffman and Wag the Dog, he said, you got to sell that line. He could sell a line, man.
He really could. A cookie full of arsenic.
Right, right.
You know? Sweet smells. God, he was great. Or From Here to Eternity. Oh, the list goes on and on.
I mean, it's just, and so to me, all of the low-budget films and the little horror movies and things like that, that I hope no one, actually, a lot of that could have actually been lost from history had it not been for IMDb to remind everybody, you know, they found all
your
that
early
stuff.
Work.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, yeah, okay, it paid the bills and it gave me practice for the big time.
You weren't paying your bills, you were paying your dues.
Right, right. Exactly.
Exactly.
Most importantly.
But so sound wise on Field of Dreams.
Okay.
Is it, I mean, when you watch it, the cracks of the bat or the ball in Ray Liotta's glove, like it makes it so romanticized our American pastime. What was it like actually recording that? You're mixing, right?
Yeah, so some of the time, especially on our days off or even in the evenings, I'm out recording like the crickets and the night music. Anytime the players are playing catch but not on camera, I'm trying to get effects of just what you said, you know, that ball coming into the mitt. And we couldn't really play on the field while the field was still going to be on camera. But the other thing that it awakened for me was that having lost two Senators teams by then, had really kind of soured on Major League Baseball, right?
DC Baseball was gone.
You know, and so when I actually got to the ball field and we got into shooting the story, it really rekindled how much I love the game of baseball. And then after we had pretty much shot the field out of the movie, then we could play on the field again. And it was just something magical about that field. And I'm so glad that Farmer didn't plow it under because he could have and put corn
back
there.
And they argued over the rights.
They did.
Weren't like two owners that divided it in
right.
half
yeah,
for
I
years
think,
and years.
I think
but
from
yeah.
the third baseline and right field the third baseline and left field belonged to another farmer's property. But they got that all settled. And I think that even in the movie when Gabby Hoffman says, you know, people will come, and they have. They've continued to come since we finished shooting that film.
Is this heaven? No, it's Iowa.
It's Iowa.
Last Field of Dreams question.
Okay.
Is it true
that
if you build it, he will come, is the director, Phil Alden Robinson?
And the only
the
only reason I know that, because I've asked him that personally, and he wouldn't cop to it one way or the other. But somewhere I saw a photo of him. I think it was in one of the audio rental places. There's a photo of him looking up at this big Neumann microphone. I said, you know, he's not in there, you know, narrating an audio book.
Right.
And so he is the voice.
So but that's still kind of mysterious. He doesn't want to confirm it.
Well, I mean, this was many years ago when I asked him, and he wouldn't cop to it. But the picture is worth a thousand words.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, Phil. You know, I'm sorry to, you know.
isn't he president of what is he? Is he SAG
well,
or what?
Well,
he was the Academy.
Yeah, he's still a governor in the Academy.
Yeah,
and we still are in touch. And for some reason. And it's kind of heartbreaking to me because as he remembers working on Field of Dreams, it was a real difficult shoot for him. As I remember it, it was like it was heaven.
Yeah.
And I said, Phil, I mean, you know, the 10th, the 15th, the 20th, I said, aren't we going back to Iowa? He said, well, no, Kevin's going. I'm not going. I said, Phil, this is an American classic, man. You have to come back.
Yeah.
You know, but that's his choice. I would love to go back and spend some time in Dyersville. I mean, it was really the beginning of me working on quality film projects.
That's awesome. Speaking of which, Field of Dreams 89 competing that year against the one that won you the Oscar, Glory. I mean, can you name a better Civil War movie? I mean, it's great stuff. Morgan Freeman, Denzel Washington, Matthew Broderick, Cary Elwes, man. And what was it like, first of all, Mr. Ed Zwick, what's it like working for him?
Well, Ed had a really great reputation working in television. He already had the 30-something. He and Marshall had that behind them. And so this was his first feature film as a director. I think the anchoring force was our wonderful producer, Freddie Fields. Hmm. And Freddie had come from the big agency side. I mean, he had some of the biggest clients in Hollywood when he was agenting. And then he decided that he wanted to produce. And I'm not quite clear on how the script got into his hands. But I know for sure how I ended up getting on the film. I was asked to come interview by this gentleman named Jan Peter Brugge. And we had worked on a small, low-budget little TV half-hour project. And I hadn't heard from him, I think, in probably 4 years or more. And then he calls me out of the blue and says, you know, Russell, I'd like for you to come interview for this Civil War movie that we're mounting. It stars Matthew Broderick, right?
Who had just done Ferris Bueller, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And so that's what I think a lot of people couldn't get ready for is the depth of Matthew Broderick's work as an actor because, you know, he comes from a stage family.
Right.
So you just put the script in front of him. What does the script call for? He can deliver. But by this time, I had worked on enough films to not only look at, okay, what the story says, but now I'm looking for the so-called aggravation factor. Okay, yeah. So Civil War movie means mostly exterior.
Yeah.
They said in Georgia. I said, okay, so that means that even though it's not going to be like Chicago cold, cold at night, yeah, probably rain. So I'm thinking, okay, well, let's see how the meeting goes. But then luckily, by even being in L.A., I would always either subscribe to the Post 1 year and on alternate years, the New York Times. And the New York Sunday Times had a story about this Civil War movie starring Matthew Broderick because Peter didn't say anything about the 54th Mass, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, on the phone call. So I'm saying, oh, wait a minute, 54th Mass, and we've signed Morgan Freeman. We're hoping that Denzel will sign
this
up.
This young guy. Yeah. You might not know him, Denzel.
Yeah. And I said, oh, you mean that Civil War movie? I said, okay, well, I'll pay them to be on this one.
Yeah, yeah.
So obviously the interview went fine. And I think the thing that I liked about Ed on set is that he had very clear ideas about how he wanted the scenes to play. But then as he really looked at the depth and the breadth of his actor core and also the technical assistance that he was getting from the reenactors, mm-hmm, who also did wonderful work on camera, you know, he began to understand that, okay, let these guys work out how the energy and the dynamics and this whole thing of, say, for instance, the scene where Morgan Freeman is standing post as a sentry with his pike, there was a discussion about how soon he should respond to Matthew Broderick and Matthew Broderick's character. Robert Gould Shaw says, well, I'd like for you to give me information about the men from time to time, you know, and so Ed thought that he should answer immediately. And Morgan says, no, you know, I'm not from a military background. I was a grave digger until you guys showed up. So I want to consider this for a minute before I respond, which he did. He was almost like Matthew was about to turn and leave. And then he says, shoes, sir. Oh, yeah. The boy was just looking for some shoes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was really, it was like going to a church or a symphony concert or something spiritual every day we worked on. It was a lot of hard work, but everybody pitched in. And you know, there were no regrets, you know. And the other thing that I think made working on Glory a little easier than working on Dances, mm-hmm, we shot in Georgia, right? Well, Jason, everybody in Georgia can cook.
Oh, that's a perk, yeah.
Almost nobody we ran into in South Dakota could cook. I mean, not to my liking. So if we hadn't had Four Stars Catering,
right,
you know, on set in South Dakota, I think the best food I had for the first half of the show was Dairy Queen. After we got to Rapid City, where we were shooting all the stuff of the winter camp, then we had real restaurants with tablecloths and things like that.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
in Pierce, South Dakota, which is the capital, back then it was, I mean, well, I'll put it this way. If you like snake or beefalo or that kind of stuff, you'd be fine. But if you wanted to be a fish eater or vegetarian, you pickings were kind of slim.
Yeah. Before we move fully to Dances, just a couple more points on Glory. Sound-wise,
because
that's your bag, baby.
Right.
Sound. Two scenes come to mind.
Okay.
Inspirational. Oh, my Lord.
Right.
He's like, I didn't expect him to do that today.
And then
the horrific, the teardrop.
Yeah,
the whip, the cracking of the whip.
Right.
For Denzel, his scene that won him the Oscar, let's
face
it.
Absolutely.
So, any memories of recording those moments?
Yes, and let's go with your second part first. So, the whip is all post-production. Because when the cast member, John Finn, who is excellent in that role, excellent as the Irish drill sergeant. When he's putting the whip on Denzel, that whip, it wasn't even like newspaper hitting you.
Right.
You know, because you really don't want to injure your actor.
But shows how he can act.
That was acting. And see, I was so far back because my once I realized that we had video assist, which I found out a few weeks ago from a CBS show, that video assist was an innovation of Jerry Lewis.
Oh.
I never knew that.
Me neither.
I had never heard that before. As many times, I mean, all these video assist monitors, and for those of you who might not know that you can actually see the camera's angle. So for someone like me, hiding microphones or microphones hanging over actors' heads, it's critical that I see how wide the frame is, and matching the distance from the actor's lips to, you know, the size of the frame is key. So that made my life easy. And since I started in TV, that meant I could, as long as I had video and audio, I could be in the next county.
Video village, baby.
You know what I'm saying? Be part of the team, right? But I didn't see that tier until I saw it on the big screen. Okay, so now let's go to the prayer meet. The prayer meet is something that I always talk about when if I do any kind of presentation on Glory. I always play that scene. Then I said, okay, so this is what happened. In the script, there is no music. There is no singing. It's just them doing their testimony in front of the tree. It's not till we get out of the crew van and Ed rushes over and says, Russell, they worked out this great little routine and they're going to sing a cappella. And every word he says after that, I'm getting more and more depressed. I'm like, okay, well, I said, Ed, you realize that usually when you do music in production, we have pre-recorded it so that we can lip sync, like music videos, which were standard by then, have always done and continue to do. So whether the actors actually can stay on pitch and stay on tempo is not a question anymore because we already have a locked recording of them.
Yeah.
So we had to essentially create a playback track from the first master shot that went from the beginning to end. And then the only thing I could do was take that one Nagra and play in the lead singer's ear what he did on the master shot. So it would at least start on pitch and on tempo. But then the longer the take goes, and you actually hear, you go back and listen to it, I think right before Jimmy Kennedy, who was the soldier that stuttered, right before he comes up, you can hear it modulate. And that's basically because coming into his shot, they took one version of the song, and coming out of the master, they took another one, and you can hear one go to the other. And the post-production mixer says that's 100% complete production sound because they couldn't do anything with it.
Yeah.
The one mistake I made when we filmed that, and it was something that I had encountered before, but because we had so many balls in the air and it was like totally unexpected, is that in the foreground there's a person playing tambourine. Generally speaking, we would always silence those little cymbals. So you see this tambourine moving back and forth, but you don't hear it. So now they can put that in post because they said now we're locked into his beat.
Right. Yeah.
Luckily, he could mostly keep time.
Yeah.
But if you wanted to slew or slide that audio forward or backward, you were kind of locked into those cymbals. So I said, okay, but it didn't prevent us from getting the statuette. The post-production mixer, Donald O. Mitchell, I always have to send out a shout to him. That was his 12th nomination. He was up for 2 Oscars that same year. He was also up for Black Rain.
Oh, wow.
So now, Jason, imagine. Okay, so it's already nerve-wracking enough that, you know, you've sat through a few different categories. I think we were maybe 10 or 11 that year, right?
It's a long show.
It's a long show. And so then the way that they read the winner, they don't say For Glory first. They read the names. So they say Donald O. Mitchell. So he's off to the stage like a bat out of hell. But we don't know for which movie yet.
Oh, wow.
And not only
that,
there were 2 Gregs. On the Black Rain crew, there was a Greg P. Russell, who I think now is a 17-time nominee.
Wow.
And then on our team was Greg C. Rudloff.
And so, Russell.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So a Greg and a Russell.
So here's Greg, and then we were like, C. Rudloff. We were like, okay, that's us.
What's that moment like? Are you... Can you even remember it, or is it just a blur?
I remember it, and it was like your heart, your whole respiratory system comes to a halt, and then you hear that name. Then we realize, okay, that's us. So there's a sigh of relief, and then we kind of have to negotiate our way through the aisle. That year, the Oscars were at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. So Donald's already up on stage. We've already agreed by him having this as his 12th nomination that he was going to speak. No two ways about it.
Right. So he's the overdue guy.
Yeah, please. And we hadn't prepared anything.
Yeah.
And so he got through his speech in about 15 seconds. Then next thing I know, he looks over his left shoulder at me and he says, "Jump in there." And I did, but I didn't, you know, I said, "I'd like to say thank you to all the people in the home countries." You know, I was glad that I was able to do that. But I didn't like, once I look at the tape, being a sound guy, that I was leaning into the microphone.
And only thinking, you would critique yourself on
that. And I was thinking, okay, dummy, if you ever get back, stand up straight. I had no clue that I was going to come
and
back the very next year.
You did get back.
So, okay, so when you look at the second video, I'm standing up straight.
Dances with Wolves, you're standing up. All right, cool. What's, before we get into the Oscar moment itself for Dances with Wolves,
okay,
let's go into the movie. How do you get hired for that job after Glory?
Well, let's talk about a word that may or may not be in effect in Hollywood these days, a word called loyalty.
Ah.
So let's go back to Phil Robinson. The only reason I get to Field of Dreams is that when the Gordon brothers, who might not be a household name to some of you all, but the Gordon brothers are the ones who created the Die Hard franchise.
Right? You may have heard of it.
May have actually seen one or two of them, right?
Or five. Or six.
And so we had worked on Phil's first movie, not the Gordon brothers, but myself and the rest of the entire crew, for that matter, had worked on his first movie called In the Mood.
Mm-hmm.
And when he got the go-ahead from the Gordon brothers, not only for the screenplay, but also to direct, he said on one condition, and that condition was that I get to hire all of my crew from my first film back.
Nice.
So that gets me on field, that gets me working with Kevin.
Kevin, and that's the connection.
So then Kevin, once he gets this project that he's directing and also starring in, he takes someone from all of his other films. So he took Transportation, I think, from Bull Durham. He took Sound from Field of Dreams. He brought script supervisor also from Field of Dreams. He brought...
He'd done what? Untouchables at that point?
And No Way Out. Yeah. You know, so again, that's loyalty. It's like people who we had a good relationship with, because, you know, when you're working on your first project, you don't want to have to remember a lot of names and kind of get used to how all these different people work. So... And the other thing I really loved about working with Kevin on Field and on Dance is he had his family around almost the whole time, meaning his wife and his kids, but also his mom and dad.
Oh, that's awesome.
And when you meet his mom and dad, you see where that salt of the earth kind of, you know, Kevin Costner, you know, character comes from. He's really just a blue-collar guy that's in a white-collar industry.
But he was, you know, a huge movie star at the time, but this was his directorial debut, right? Talk about what was it like watching that growth happen? Were there moments, I know you've told me stories before about you shoot everything this way, you turn around and everything
right.
Were there any sort of like growing moments where you saw him sort of dealing with those first time challenges and then watching him overcome to win Gods of Oscars, you know? What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, because I think that he was very smart in how, you know, when you have a big film screenplay, I don't know if your audience appreciates the fact that in most cases, we almost never shoot this in story continuity. Like you would rehearse a play.
Shot out of order.
It's completely shot out of order. It's basically location availability or actor availability. So since we pretty much own the state.
Light availability.
Right. Since we pretty much own the state of South Dakota while we were out there. So what he did in scheduling the movie is that at the beginning of the shoot, he only did the scenes where he is in the movie. So it's kind of like him coming across the prairie, him discovering Fort Sedgwick. And then I want to say early on, we did the scene where he gets assigned, you know, the task of going out to the prairie. And then we started to...
the hell was that? Oh, I think they started to buzz in here. But
okay. So then we started the process of adding...
Let me make sure it didn't... No, we're still going.
Okay. Right. So then we started the process of adding a few Native American actors in. So I want to say Wind in His Hair discovers, you know, the fort. And so he slowly built up to the larger scenes and, you know, the buffalo hunt, which we actually ran, I want to say 5,000 head of Buffalo, and that was the first time since the 19th century that they'd had that type of run. The one thing that made it difficult is that, generally speaking, if we're shooting, say you and I having this conversation in the studio, so you're on one side of the room, on the other, so we would start with a wide shot of you and then come to a medium shot of you, then we come to a tight shot of you, and then we turn the camera and the lights around and we do the same thing looking in my direction. So Kevin, for some reason, had to do wide this way, wide the other way, medium this way, medium the other way. And so that, I would say, contributed to the movie going over schedule. But as long as he felt comfortable that the performances on camera were going to cut together, then that's the way we did it. And another tribute to Kevin's commitment to this film, and I'm fairly sure this is accurate, that whatever our contracted end date was, I want to say it was probably the end of September or October that year. The day after that, any overage came out of his pocket.
Oh, wow.
So I'm fairly sure a lot of the money that we pocketed for the next month and a half or so of shooting came from his profits from Bull Durham and other residuals.
Right, right.
You know, and maybe he had other investors on the side. A great producer in Jim Wilson. Again, another stellar director of photography, Dean Semler. You know, so I had worked with an English gentleman, Freddie Francis, on Glory, and an Australian gentleman for Dances. And I mean, it really was the hallmark of teamwork.
Yeah.
Because you can get some cameramen who feel that the whole movie's about picture and everybody else's department is secondary. Yeah. And these guys were complete team players.
Speak a little to how Dances with Wolves sort of, what was so great about it, and obviously it won Best Picture and everything, what was so great about it was it sort of showed a different side to the Old West. We've
right.
seen, you know,
yes.
where the Comanches are the evil ones
right.
hunting John Wayne and, you know, all those old movies, but this showed, you know, the Native American sort of plight of it, and it's almost, I mean, there have been old movies, Broken Arrow and stuff, but, you know, it's interesting that it almost took till 1990 to get something that mainstream, but... Speak sort of to that, because in a way, Glory, you showed another side of the Civil War.
Right, absolutely.
This, you're showing another side of the frontier. So
right.
speak sort of to how important that
is. And I think that even, Jason, while we were just in the pre-production stage in South Dakota, there was a lot of grumbling in the state about, okay, you know, why is this movie going to highlight what the Native Americans did, you know, because... You know, if you grew up watching Westerns, the Native Americans were the enemy universally. So this film really pointed out that, okay, yeah, yes, there's Western expansion, and yes, you know, the pioneers and the settlers were moving their way west, and so the America we know now is as a result of that. But the thing that I think that the movie pointed out was that, okay, so even within the Native American community, there were enemies.
Yeah.
You know, which we showed. I mean, there were peaceful nations and there were warlike nations. But, you know, one of the things that I think the film really pointed out is that the Native Americans were already into conservation of resources. We only kill what we're actually going to eat or right. use for, you know, clothing and wardrobe or shelter. We're not just going to slaughter for slaughter's sake. And then I think that the attitude of the cavalry, you know, that came later in the movie was fairly typical of the fact that, I mean, in their military posture, they had to assume that Native Americans were the enemy. Mm-hmm. So they hadn't really had the experience that Kevin Costner's character had to see them as human beings raising families and wanting the same thing for their kids mm-hmm. and, you know, and their community as you would want for yours. Mm-hmm. And I think that Michael Blake's screenplay was amazing just on paper.
Man.
I mean, and because I almost turned that film down, Jason.
You almost turned down Dance
for
the
Wolves. I was just outside for like 4.5-5 months on Glory.
True.
And now I'm going to do another exterior.
Civil War era exterior.
Right, which I'm like, okay, here's the aggravation factor again. You know, long days. And I think we started in July. So the prairie is hot as heck in July.
Yeah.
And then by the time we got to November, I was in full duster. Mm-hmm. A Resistol hat, got my first pair of cowboy boots on one of the scouts because I had scrupulously avoided any Western wear while I lived in L.A., especially after Urban Cowboy came
out. Right,
everybody
right,
started
right.
acting like they were, you know, breaking steers and stuff. But once you step on a cactus that's about this tall and it goes right through your Nikes, it's like, okay, yeah, cowboy boots.
Yeah, I get it now.
And then you come back, even as African-American with sunburn on the back of your neck from wearing baseball caps, you realize on the prairie there are no trees. There is no shade. So you had to bring your shade with you.
Right.
And then a few months later when the wind started to really kick up, all of a sudden, here's the duster, baby. You know, like Once Upon a Time in the West. I said, so once I got back from that movie, I said, you can call me Dakota now, all right?
Do you still go by that ever?
Only for people that know me from that film. But now from a technical point of view, Dancers was almost the easiest film I worked on in the sense that we were so far out in the middle of nowhere that there were no 20th century sounds that wafted into the track.
Right.
Which in Glory, we were always kind of like at the edge of Savannah and, you know, so traffic, and they were also working on the bridge, you know, so, and Freddie Fields was very cognizant of that. In this movie, Jason, I got overflown by one airplane in the entire time I was out there, and it was a B-1 bomber.
Wow.
And it was at altitude. That was it. No doctors flying around on the weekend to kind of show their kids, you know, the great prayer.
Well, our listeners don't appreciate that enough, that, so, you know, an airplane will, you know, screw with what you're doing.
Yeah, especially when you're doing a period piece. It's like, there were no airplanes in that period of history, right? There weren't any motor vehicles to speak of. So the
Union's advantage was the railroad.
Right, exactly.
no plane.
Right. Yeah. So that actually made, and the other thing that was amazing is you could be almost a city block or more away from somebody and still hear normal conversation on the wind.
Wow.
So when you see those scenes of the Native Americans and even the old bad Westerns, you know, listening to the wind, and they can say, there's two riders approaching or 10 riders approaching. That's not an exaggeration. I was amazed. I was like, wow. I said, who's that talking? I said, I can actually hear them, you know, because there's nothing competing with you.
Wind in his hair has dialogue in his hair.
Really?
Wow,
right.
Wow. So that's legit.
That's legit, man.
That's pretty cool.
You know?
All right, so Oscar experience, part two.
Okay.
Now you're going as a winner.
Okay.
So do you walk in a little taller?
Hey, man.
Or is it, and you're sitting there and you hear your name called again, it's still just as special.
It's as special because this time, well, first of all, unfortunately, Don didn't get nominated because he always does great work. Mm. But we don't have competing people on two different crews, okay? Right. So I don't have to worry about that. And for me now, it's even though everybody else had said I was going to win a second time, I said, there's absolutely no way. There's no chance. And it's almost the same type of movie. I said, there's no way. And each year there were great movies up against us from in the sound category. But a funny
thing. That year you had Goodfellas
it's like so a funny thing happened. For your listeners is that, so the ABC camera people have a seating chart. So obviously the actors are usually in the first two or three rows, and you have directors and then you have writers. And so as you go deeper and deeper into the auditorium, we know where the documentarians are sitting, the sound people. So after the commercial break and two of the best things about both of those years were those were Billy Crystal's first 2 years.
Oh, wow. And best Oscar host ever.
Trust me, he knows how to work a room. It felt like you were like in his living room and he was just telling jokes for his family.
Wow.
So as in the commercial break, the ABC cameraman comes up the aisle and he starts pointing towards our section because this is where the sound people are sitting. Yeah. And then when they say Jeffrey Perkins, who's our lead mixer, I know that's us. There's no like waiting to hear the second or third name. So I stand up. So the cameraman is not expecting the person standing right next to him to stand up. And so from my TV background, I see him racking focus. And I also notice that red light on the camera called a tally light is not on.
Mm.
So I just stand there. And once
he's
ready and I see that light come on, now we take the entire walk all the way up to the stage. And then when I get to the stage, I notice that my post-production compadres, they're still in the aisle, glad-handing. They're still, you know, working their way through the people. So, of course, I have to speak. And as Donald O. Mitchell did for me the year before, as soon as the post-production mixers got up there, I did my speech in about 15 or 17 seconds, and I threw it through the lead mixer, who was also celebrating his birthday that day.
Oh, wow.
You know, so
happy birthday.
But let me tell you one thing that's majorly different from people who win these days than in our day. Because it's probably the most ridiculous question I've ever heard anyone ask.
Let's hear it.
Is when you win your statuette. Now, this is the first year. You win your statuette. And when you go immediately off stage, there's a table of statuettes.
Right.
And an Academy member who writes the number off the back of your statuette on a list. So they'll always be associated with your name. Then they ask you this question. They don't do this anymore because they fixed this. Well, would you like to leave your statuette with us tonight? And then in a couple of weeks when we put the badge on, you come up and pick it up at the office. Yeah. And I'm like, no.
Engrave it now.
Yeah, we'll take it now. And then when the badges come in, you can come down to the office and have it affixed. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, so now they actually have the machine there on site.
Yeah.
And I'm saying now they've probably had that for a few years now. But I was like, what? I just got the thing and you want me to give it back? How am I getting into parties, you know, without this? Without this, baby, I'm an Oscar winner. Where's your Oscar? Well,
this is my badge of honor right here.
Yeah, this is my American Express card. Don't leave home
without it. That's all. Well, it's interesting because I went out and covered the Oscars this year.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Leo gets it engraved backstage and all that. Yeah. But it's interesting. I mean, I want to go to your other movies. Maybe we can rapid fire because we've been in here a bit. But
hey, man.
We could talk all day about this. But talk about, you said those Oscar days versus nowadays. What's your take on this past year when I was out there? The Oscars So White hashtag was the big thing. What's been your take on that whole scenario?
Well, and I'm glad that we can put this out in the open, because the process, and I think the only way a person not in the industry could conceivably understand this process is very opaque. In a sporting event, not only do you know what team or what individual won, but you also know the score.
It's clear cut.
It's clear cut.
Everybody saw it.
So we don't know. In other words, I don't know whether, for example, whether I won by one vote or by 100 votes. You know what I'm saying? The only time you really know something of the number is when there is an actual tie. Other than that, you have no idea. You'll never know. Mm. Only Price Waterhouse knows. So... also, think of how many people have had great sporting careers but don't end up in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
So the Academy is essentially a Hall of Fame. Its real role, even though they want to change its image, but its real role traditionally had been to keep people out until they had achieved a certain amount of professional and artistic status. Wait, so that's number one. Number two, I want to say last year, in typical years, you have more than 300 films that are eligible to be considered in all categories, and say if those 300 films had at least 10 actors. Mm-hmm. So that's 3,000 acting roles that have to be whittled down to 20 nominations.
Yeah.
Okay? So just mathematically, it's really hard to get nominated. It's even harder to win. But if you don't get nominated, you have no chance of winning. The other misconception, I think, that where the Oscar So White tag comes in, to me, it also smacks that you're saying that these people aren't talented. They just got nominated because they were white. No, nobody said white men can't act. They may have had a movie called White Men Can't Jump. But, you know, I've seen a whole lot of serious. And then I also have seen a lot of white folks who put in great performances and don't get nominated either. I mean, and we can either go recently, like, say, for instance, one of my favorite Tom Hanks movies. You know, Captain Phillips.
Yeah.
Any other year, he's up there with his tux on.
Yeah.
Robert Redford that same year.
Yeah.
I mean.
Oh, for when he was out, All Is Lost.
All Is Lost.
Are and Tom kidding? Hanks is doing that same reason, shock at the end of Captain Phillips.
Oh, please. Okay. But, right. I mean, but I get it.
He'd won before. Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Okay, so here's the other part. So now, the movie industry is a business. Mm. And of those 300 films that came out last year, the ones that were aimed at an African-American or other ethnic audiences weren't that many. Mm-hmm. And there were maybe only three of them that were what we would call Oscar bait.
Right.
So Concussion, definitely Straight Out of Compton.
Creed,
right? And so, you know, nominations here and there. But again, there's no real rhyme or reason. But now this is what I know about the Academy in general, regardless of ethnicity. My years as a member, which started back in 1990, the Academy tends to always take the softer option.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so like one of my years I point to would be the year Inception was out, but The King's Speech wins Best Picture. Now, to me, the Academy should be pushing the art form forward.
Yeah.
And trust me, there's nothing wrong with The King's Speech. It's very solid, very well acted, you know, but the Brits do this day in and day out. I mean, most of these British actors come out of the womb reciting Richard III. Okay. You know, so there's nothing, to me, there's nothing groundbreaking about the film. It's just a really well done film.
Right.
Whereas Inception, I mean, the script, the visual effects, even the acting, I mean, so
you're happens all the time. I mean,
you know, and I mean, so if you don't want, if Inception mystified you, then how about The Fighter?
Yeah.
Hell of a film that same year.
Yeah.
Okay, let the Brits honor the Brits, you know. If you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like, because the King's Speech won the BAFTAs as well.
What is this? King's Speech is 2010, I think?
Yeah, something like,
Yeah, and or Black Swan, Social Network, and then King's Speech wins, you know?
Yeah, I mean, so the year that Glory doesn't even get a Best Picture nomination.
Well, Do the Right Thing was the, you know, boundary breaker, and that doesn't win. It goes to Driving Miss Daisy, the safer
pick. Driving Miss Daisy, you know? So both of them about race relations.
Right.
But one group of guys has bayonets in their hand. The other guy has a steering wheel in his hand.
Yeah.
Same with when Cuba Gooding wins for Jerry Maguire. To me, that's the year Samuel L. Jackson should have won for Time to Kill. So, you know.
And then each of those slights is made up later down the line, you know.
So on the other hand, if I'm being real cynical, you know, I say, okay. So one of the things that is happening from on the business point of view, which is unfortunate, is that when films are aimed at African-American audiences that aren't comedies, when they're serious straight dramas, which are usually what Oscar bait tends to mean, then there's not the kind of audience support, meaning the kind of dollars through the box office, and which is the same in a lot of ways for white films. I mean, if the Weinsteins are losing money on some of their really highbrow films. Mm-hmm. They're also losing money on films like Mandela Long Walk Home, which was an excellent film.
Yeah.
So no one is going to prevent you from taking a wheelbarrow full of money and a certificate of insurance and making as many films as you want. See, so that's where we are now. If you don't mind taking your own risk, telling your story. So that's kind of why I felt really good about Nate Parker's effort for Birth of a Nation, because he found financiers himself and put his own money up as well.
Right.
And I think that paradigm not only ensures that you get to tell the story you want to tell. Mm-hmm. So that's part one. The part two is that it has to be supported. And also, of course, the Academy members have to see it, which means that you have to be willing to pony up at least another $2 million to make sure we get all of the Academy screeners.
Is that what happened to Selma? Didn't they, like, not get the screeners out to everybody?
They didn't get the screeners out to the Screen Actors Guild nominating committee, and I don't know if it was just them or the general body.
This is a great movie.
It was, and it still is a great movie. And so the other challenge, which I think also people outside the industry may not have understood, because, well, they said that the movie got slighted, but if Best Picture is the highest award you can garner— it did get a Best Picture nomination. I think it would be much harder for Ava DuVernay or any woman to get a nomination out of that directing branch. I hate to say that.
You're still going
to
knock that barrier down.
That barrier is harder and higher than just about any of the others in the Academy.
Wow.
So for Kathryn Bigelow to be the first woman after all these years of great films directed by women, you know what I'm saying? So
way to go on that one.
So hopefully with the additional members, and they actually took the cap off of how many members they can add per year, so that may help. I'm not sure about brooming out the older members, if that is completely the right way to go, because one of the things I remember while I was still working daily in the business is that if I was also part of the Foreign Language Committee, and if you're working on a film, you're not working usually 8-hour days and going home.
Right.
You might be working 12, 15-hour days. And so who else has time to go see all those films, except for some of the members who are retired from active, you know,
so film. So that's the argument why the veteran, older.
I mean, I mean, and also the fact that anybody with a permanent tan or a different ethnicity could win an Oscar is due to white votes. Mm. So everybody in the Academy can't be a bigot. Right. You know, and the other thing that you wouldn't know by being, unless you're in the room, is you should hear how some of the members just lambast some of these films. I mean, I heard my wife and I were just amazed at one of the members. We went to see The Revenant. Oh, I want to say we saw it at CAA, and then we saw it again on the Fox lot. And this one gentleman, he just trashed this film like it was some low budget stinker, you know, from somebody's film school. And I was like, wow. Wow. I mean, and he wasn't just going after Leo.
This is the reigning best director. Alejandro.
I mean, and I'm like, are you kidding me? But it's just amazing how diverse.
It's a polarizing movie, story-wise, I guess. But visually, come on.
Look, I mean, first, I love Leo's work anyway. It's like, what? So he had to get eaten by a bear three times to get his Oscar? I think the year that that was most difficult for him, and as a voter, when he had Blood Diamond and Departed out in the same year. So 06. Which one do you vote for?
You think it split the vote?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, which one do you vote for? Yeah. And both the entire Academy would have to vote for both of them in order for him to edge out the other roles.
That's almost like one of those where you wish it was like in the very early years of the Oscars when they awarded a person for their whole year's body of work.
I'm
talking like the first couple of years.
Yeah, exactly.
Then he would have won probably.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean,
it's funny how it works.
What do you have to do? You know, I mean.
So correct me if I'm misunderstanding you, but it sounds almost like you're saying that the problem is less within, you know, voters, you know, maliciously not, you know, snubbing something, and more in the wider representation of what's gets whittled down in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely mathematically more difficult. But again, if you want to, in my opinion, if you want to win an Oscar, as an Oscar voter, I'll tell you myself, when I'm in the movie theater seeing something for the first time, I want to be transported. Okay. So there was one actor who was in a film this past year who has been nominated two other occasions. And on those two other occasions, he put in much stronger performances.
Are we allowed to say who it is?
Yeah. Will Smith.
Oh, okay.
We remember. Now, I might not be able to tell you every film I saw in a calendar year, but I can tell you I thought he was much better than Ali.
Yeah.
He got nominated. Okay.
Pursuit of Happiness.
I thought he was much better in Pursuit of Happiness. He got nominated. He was even much better to me in I Am Legend.
Yeah.
He didn't get a nomination. But I mean, I mean, you saw a side of Will Smith. Yeah. You saw some depth in Will in that situation. I was like, wow.
So that's what people got to remember. You're not just comparing off that year's crop. You're comparing off your own votes and everything you remember each of those people.
I also am old enough to remember that. Because, again, too many folks may think that this has something to do strictly with you having a permanent tan. It's like, well, Hitchcock doesn't have an Oscar on his mantle.
Yeah. How is that? Life Achievement was all he got. He never won for director. How is that?
You know what I'm saying?
He's Mr. Director.
I mean, Paul Newman, it took him to The Color of Money. So you're telling me HUD?
Yeah.
You're telling
Cool
me
Hand Luke?
Cool Hand Luke. Hustler? The Verdict?
Butch Cassidy?
What?
Oh, Verdict is so good.
The Verdict.
Yeah.
I mean, and at that stage in his career, I mean, when he finds out that his girlfriend is playing, Charlotte Rampling is playing for the other side, I mean, the look on his face is almost as bad as when Al Pacino finds out that Fredo was the
broke
traitor.
His heart.
And I mean, it's like that punch, you could feel him get punched in the gut. I mean, see, that's what I'm looking for, Jason. I want to be torn apart and put back together when I'm watching you on the screen.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, sometimes the movie's better than the actor performances individually, and sometimes the actor carries the film. You know, so there's a lot more in the calculus than I think that meets the eye. So I've had people argue with me, well, there should be. I said, okay, so you're telling me you want to go back to black baseball, or do you want these athletes to win the World Series ring?
Right.
Do you want to go back to the black football championship, or do you want to have a Super Bowl ring? You know, so we have one playing field, one standard.
Yeah.
Okay, not saying that any other group that wants to give you an award shouldn't be given these awards. I'm fine with that.
Right.
But my goal was to be the best, whatever that meant. And it's again, Karl Malone, 18 great seasons in the NBA, no ring.
No ring for the mailman.
Okay.
Drop it in the mail.
So what? Are you going to indict the entire NBA for that?
He just was going against Jordan.
You know.
You're going against Daniel Day-Lewis. You know what are you going
to
do?
You know what I'm saying? So sometimes, I'm the first to tell you, you can do great work, and then you also do need some luck.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you need some luck.
With the right timing, yeah.
Right timing. So, again, this year I don't think that that's going to be a problem in terms of the Oscars so white because beyond Birth of a Nation, there's so many really good performances that have yet to hit the screen. Some of them have already been out. So I'm fairly sure that we're going to have a diverse group of nominees. But again, if we end up with a completely diverse Academy in the years to come and we have another year where we have 20 nominees that are all white, now what?
Yeah.
Is it because they were actually the 20 best performances?
Yeah, yeah.
Or, you know, I'm saying... Yeah. So I'm not speaking as a representative of the Academy. I'm just speaking as a voting member. It's like I see the arguments on both sides, and I think it really comes down to you have to have a pretty mean horse to win at the end of it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, for the years I tried to say.
You
got to
be Secretariat,
baby. Yeah, I mean, for years I tried to say every time Meryl Streep got nominated, I said, oh, man, again. But I'm sorry, she delivers.
I mean, maybe the greatest actress of all time, right?
I'm sorry. I'm telling you, I tried to say she was overrated.
You can't.
She proved me wrong each time.
Yeah.
So, like I said, maybe white men can't jump, you know, based on that movie title, but these folks can act.
I love it. It's such a fascinating conversation, man. Follow me mentally here. We're going to backtrack.
Okay. All right.
Because when you mentioned Michael Fredo, it sparked it.
Right,
and we've
right.
been talking Denzel and stuff. So, 2001, Denzel wins for Training Day, right?
Right.
Everyone's
right.
like, why do you have to go crooked to take it?
Yeah,
that was
the
Jadakiss song.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's he should have won in 92 for Malcolm X.
Right,
but
right.
Pacino had to get it for Son of a Woman because he didn't get it for Godfather because Brando did, right? But Brando probably should have gotten it in 51, but they gave it to Bogart because he didn't win it back at Cast. You know what I mean? So it goes on and on and on.
It's like I guarantee you on Oscar night, Emmy night, Grammy night, American Music Award night, BAFTA night, whatever I'm missing, Country Music Awards, they're always going to be more disappointed than anointed.
Ooh.
That's just the math.
That's a good line.
I'm sorry. And I've been fortunate that of the nominations that I've had, I've only been disappointed once, and that would have been for my third Emmy for the Temptations miniseries. Mm-hmm. And not only was that a great project, but it was really great to work on, and I really appreciated Suzanne DePass and her history at Motown and the details that we put into that. But, you know, hey, baby, you can't win them all.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad to be able to be in the history books. I'm glad that I can put my statuette someplace where more people will see them than the ones that traipse through my place. But, you know, I think that, like sports, there are a lot of great careers in sports, and we know them. I'm sure the sports fanatics can recite these statistics a lot better than I can. And not everybody gets to that Hall of Fame. And essentially, that's what all of the academies have done. Now, people will say, well, look at the Tonys and look at the Emmys. And look, I said, yes, absolutely. And so now are we saying, because my question is Hamilton a better play than much of what we've ever seen on the screen?
Right.
You know, so don't just say that they won it because they had a diverse cast or whatnot, or was it that the Tonys? No, that product was sensational.
Right.
Okay, so, you know, it's not as easy to make a film, a great TV show, a great play, and the attention to detail, and you've got a lot of people like me and you, say, if you were an Academy member, you'd be saying, yeah, that was good. I mean, but it did make my heart skip a beat.
Right.
It's worth a nomination, but I don't know if it's going to clear, you know?
Right.
I mean, there's probably a better system somewhere, but this is the system we have.
Right.
You know, so all I say is you're not going to get there unless you persevere and you need a little luck. No two ways about it.
And you got lucky 2 years in a row.
Hey, I mean, it's like that I would, no one would have been able to convince me that was going to happen.
Definitely. Well, I know we've been gone like an hour, but let's kind of more, it doesn't have to be one word answers, but let's rapid fire these.
Okay.
Spike Lee and Jungle Fever. Well, just give me a memory of each of these.
Spike Lee, great crew, difficult shoot.
Why is that?
Well, not the most.
Here goes a rapid fire.
not the most cooperative director I've worked for.
Oh, okay. Okay. You're going to leave it at that?
Leave it at that.
Okay. Boomerang with Eddie Murphy, Robin Givens, Halle Berry.
Big fun. big fun. I mean, great cast, great crew. I mean, and what's not to like about 5-day weeks in New York?
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I'm saying? And Paramount Films treated us all really good on that film.
That's awesome.
It was great working for Eddie, though.
Oh.
I mean, that particular show, Eddie was on top of his game, and we just had a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
That's awesome. You and Eddie thanking Jerry Lewis.
Right.
Night Professor and Video Village.
Exactly.
Antoine Fuqua and Denzel on Training Day. They're coming out Magnificent Seven this weekend.
Yep. Well, I'll say for directors that came from music videos, Antoine was probably one of the most prepared I'd ever worked with. And he had a book of storyboards that we all got at the beginning of the shoot. Yeah. So we always knew what was up. And that preparation paid off. No two ways about it.
What was it, before we move on, Denzel then versus Glory? I mean, you saw him as a young buck, and
now
as Mr. King Kong ain't got nothing on me. Do you guys reminisce about Glory on set, or is it more just, go to work?
The thing about Denzel is he comes to work in character. Yeah. So there's not a lot of chit-chat.
You didn't want to mess with him then.
No, and so if I had to go to him for a technical reason, first I'd make eye contact with him, and then I'd say, I'd do a little hand signal saying I'm going to have to make an adjustment because I don't want to, take him out of his zone. So we really didn't get to chat much about Glory, but I'll tell you one thing for sure. He scared the real gang members on the set because a lot of those guys in the background were real people.
They brought in, I remember.
Yeah, they weren't just extras with, press-on tats. They were the real deal.
That's so cool. That's a great movie. Billy Friedkin, who we both saw at the Exorcist steps, remember? I'm just cracking up. I'm calling him William Friedkin, and you're saying, hey, old Billy.
Right.
Rules of Engagement and TV version of 12 Angry Men.
12 Angry Men.
Which won you an Emmy?
I was so impressed working with Mr. Friedkin because, first of all the great directors I have had the honor of working with, he's the first one that invited me to the table read. And so he's got me on one side and the cameraman, the director of photography on the other, looking at his notes. So we already have a vision of what he wants to shoot. When we did Rules of Engagement, the other honor for me was also working with Richard Zanuck.
Wow.
I mean, you're talking about an uber producer. And just to see Richard work his magic. And he said, as a producer and all you young producers out there, he said, Russell, says my job is to keep all the studio madness, the legal mumbo jumbo, and all this other business related stuff out of my director's hair until he says that's a wrap. Then we can chit chat about that at dinner afterwards. But while he's focused on the actors and the camera position, I'm there to backstop all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And I just wish I'd had more time to chit chat with him because what a class act. Billy, a lot of people think of Billy in his earlier days when he was probably a little bit more of a shouter. The experience I had with Billy was he would only shout at you if on the day, Mo, because he called everybody Mo, you had promised him something and you couldn't deliver. So you better deliver. When Billy asks you a question, you better have an answer. Mm-hmm. So he wanted me to record a local Moroccan group. Yeah, we were in Morocco, a local Moroccan group, and he was going to waft some of this music into the track. So he says, okay, Mo, how about my music? I said, Tuesday, 5 p.m. And now he's asking me that while he's got his hands in front of his face setting up a shot. It's got nothing to do with the music. He just looks to his left. How about my music, Mo? 5 p.m. Tuesday. Because I had seen a visual effects guy not have the answer. Once, twice, third time, next day he was on a plane.
So that's why you were saying, hey, Mo, down at the Exorcist. Yeah, and get it.
And Mo came from field. Mo came from the French Connection because the real cops at French Connection is based on called each other Mo.
Gotcha.
So
not Popeye. Popeye and Mo.
Yeah, so he picked that up from them, from the NYPD.
That's fantastic. Well, we could sit and talk forever. I know we've gone on forever, but before you do go, I want to, I do have to ask you.
Okay.
How'd you get into American University? That's where I met you when I was in grad school. I don't think I never had you as a professor, but you were always around. I know, So, how did that happen and why has it sort of been important for you to sort of give back in that way?
Okay, so the first time or the second time?
Give me both.
Okay, so while I was a student at Wilson, some students from American walked down Nebraska Avenue and came to Wilson and talked to the student body about the opportunities at this college that was right up the street from us. And I hadn't really thought about American. I was, in my mind, going to Boston University. So after I applied to both and a couple other places, and American said yes, then I kept looking at the weather reports in Boston. I said, no, let me stay home. So then,
plus Terrence Mann was doing his thing up there.
I said, so then as my 20 plus years in LA were kind of coming to a close, and a lot of the work that I was really interested in doing was going to Canada. The then dean of American U, Larry Kirkman, had come out to find some of his alumni, and we had lunch together. And I said, you know what? I wouldn't mind teaching. I mean, that's not what he pitched me with. He pitched me with, could I contribute to the curriculum somehow?
Right.
And I said, yeah, but on campus. And so, you know, we wish, and it's not his command, but they put it in motion. So I came back in 2002. And then when I took a look at the curriculum, it was not that far away from what I was looking at in the 70s. And we had great production courses, great writing courses, great fundamental stuff in journalism, but they weren't really that strong on the business of show. And to me, the business of show was also much more important graduating today than it would have been in the mid-70s. And I really just like working with the young people and seeing them pursue their dreams. And I always have people practice their Oscar speech. They said, but I said, no, trust me, you're going to have your opportunity. And so take it from my mistakes and go up there and deliver. Deliver.
That's
okay.
Great. So what all course are you teaching now?
So this semester, the fall semester, I usually teach film and video one, which is introduction. So not only camera work, sound, some editing, but I try to impress upon my students, being, you know, a Hollywood veteran, that I'm there to show them how to get large format results with small format tools. Mm-hmm. Then I have a all graduate course in the weekend program called Developing Fiction Films, which is all about raising money through equity investors and that sort of thing. In the spring, a sound design course, and another course called Executive Suite, which allows our alums primarily to Skype back onto campus and talk about what's happening in various fields like television, music, film, even web design. You know, anything that I think that young, soon-to-be, you know, Barry Levinson, the future needs to know about going into the business.
And more than just a professor, a mentor, and maybe even a producer for an AU student, right?
Yeah, if the project is good enough, I don't mind picking up the phone and see if I can make some connections. Because to me, that was one of the whole reasons that the schools like the SCs, UCLA's, NYU's of the world have such a strong alumni base, because they reach back and find new talent, and they know exactly who to call and exactly how to put them in play. Hopefully, they also can spot the people who maybe not as serious as they need to be. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that working the Watergate hearing showed me was that I could go the distance, to go back to Field of Dreams, because we were working 22-hour days, 5 days a week.
Yeah.
So if that's not enough to dissuade you from show business, there was going to be.
and it also taught you to keep the tapes. Don't delete
exactly.
them.
Yeah, exactly. which brings me to an interesting point, I think. And I asked Oliver Stone about this, and he kind of said he wasn't sure. But if you go back and look at Oliver Stone's Nixon, there's a quick shot where it's supposed to be Alexander Butterfield. Oh, and by the way, trivia, I was working the control audio board the day Alexander Butterfield announced that we have the tapes of the president, because that was an NBC day.
Wow.
That was by the time the hearings were only broadcast by one network at a time.
Wow.
And then after that revelation, all three of them started to carry it again. But there's a little scene where you see he's got like four Wallenzach, or U-Her, depending on, because they all have the same frame, four recorders in a cabinet. And you see him taking the tape off of one of them. And as an archivist veteran from the Library of Congress, Nixon erased the 18 minutes off the tape he had in his hand. But theoretically, there are two other copies. And I'm guessing, I don't have any information one way or the other, but I'm guessing that Butterfield has that 18 minutes.
Oh, there was a copy.
I mean, I can't see him giving away all the copies for them to, you know. You know,
I'm
fairly sure. You know, I mean, this is just me from looking at the scene in the movie. Because you have all of this conversation in the movie. Now, maybe it's all of what Oliver Stone wrote and has nothing to do with what was that 18-minute gap was really about. But it's interesting. It's just like a one quick shot there, but it said, and some people say it spoke to me.
You're always a curious mind, my friend.
Hey, man, you know. It's like I think my background as a music student really had me tuned into listening to cues. And even now, even though I haven't really done location work, and what I've been back here now 14 years, I still always hear what shouldn't be in the mix.
Right.
You know, so I hear the buzzing over there behind you. And, you know, when I walk into a classroom, I always hear the projector fan and things like that. But it could also save your life. That's why I also tell students, you know, take those earbuds out. At least take one of them out. You know, because you'll never hear that bus that's going to run you over, you know.
I'm walking here.
Yeah, I'm walking here, baby.
Oh, that's the perfect place to leave it. Russell, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure, man.
Guys, the museum opens this weekend. I think you need tickets, but so if you can't get there this weekend,
definitely,
go see it soon.
I would suggest you wait a few months because it's going to be a mob.
Yeah. I know there's like a free concert series that's free. Maybe go do that, but go to the museum a little bit.
There are going to be a lot of people there this weekend. It's going to be pandemonium. Not the kind of the National Zoo. It's going to be pandemonium.
Oh, but pandemonium.
Yeah,
I see what you did there.
Yeah, yeah.
But once you do get there, check out the two Oscars and the NAGRA of Mr. Russell Williams here. Thanks so much for joining us on
TLP.
This is great.
My pleasure.